Welcome to Left, Right, and Unwanted, the podcast where people across the political spectrum discuss ideas and politics. I'm Lauren, and I'm the left.
I'm Morgan, and I'm the right.
I'm Luke, and I'm the unwanted. Today, we're going to be starting a mini-series on the 1619 Project and the 1776 Commission. So, to begin the discussion, I'm going to ask a question. What makes a good map?
It needs to be easy to understand and read, have a clear scale, have a clear key, a nice title so you know what you're looking at.
I would say as long as the map is accurate and suits its purpose, it is a good map, because I suppose it kind of depends on what you want to use it for.
The reason I asked that question is because there's a book called The Landscape of History by John Lewis Gaddis, which compares historiography to map making. So Gaddis argues that there is no single best map. So Jorge Luis Borges wrote a short story called Exactitude in Science, which talks about an empire where the art of cartography attained such perfection that the cartographers' guilds struck a map of the empire whose size was that of the empire and which coincided point for point with it. The following generations, who were not so fond of the study of cartography, saw that the vast map was useless, and they delivered it up to the inclemencies of sun and winters. In the deserts of the West, still today, there are tattered ruins of that map inhabited by animals and beggars. There's no single best map. You can't just have a map that represents literally everything and use it for everything. We use, as Lauren mentioned, maps for different things, like an atlas, a highway map, which I used to use when I drove around, which shows my age. A highway map will exaggerate certain features of the landscape and neglect others. You need to be able to see the routes, their numbers, and the cities they run between. You don't need to know the nature of the soil or the vegetation. Or if you ever look at a subway map, it is not accurate in terms of the exact direction each of the rails run or the distances between them. It just shows you stops, and it's a very oversimplified version of how the rail tracks actually look. So when you're evaluating if a map is a good map or a bad map, you have to look at the purpose for which it was made. Maps vary scale and content according to need. A world map has a different purpose from one intended to identify bicycle paths or garbage dumps. And importantly, maps are not free from preconceptions. There's always some prior reason for what's shown and not shown. As I mentioned previously, Gaddis is comparing maps to the making of history. I'll ask you the next question, which is, what makes a good history?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is accuracy, which is difficult, and the saying history is written by the winners. I imagine there's a lot that goes into what makes history.
I'd say again, it goes back to the purpose of the history. And there's so many different methods for record. Like, you look at the differences between oral history handed down generationally, or going back and looking through printed sources from a time period. There's so many different ways to look at it that, again, I think it has to be purpose driven, but good history should be based in facts, like you said, Morgan, accuracy. And then I guess there's some artistic license depending on who's telling the story and what they want to emphasize, but it should be rooted in accuracy.
Well, thanks for stealing my thunder, guys.
Full marks.
Just like with the maps, you can't do a one-for-one correspondence. And as Gaddis says, to try to capture everything that happened to an ordinary person on an ordinary day in an ordinary place took James Joyce over 700 pages in Ulysses. So imagine turning Joyce loose on an account, say, of Napoleon at Waterloo. The level of detail would be such that most readers would nod off before the great man, Napoleon, I mean, not Joyce, had even got his underwear on. You have to leave things out when you're writing a history. You can't just include everything. And so what do you leave out? It goes to, as Lauren mentioned, the purpose of it. Just like maps, histories have purposes. You can even talk about the same thing from many different perspectives. Like Waterloo, you could write an account of Waterloo that's focused on military history. So you talk about the tactics of the armies and the generals. You would leave probably the political history out of it. Or you could be writing the history of a biography of Napoleon. Or you could be writing the history of European foreign policy of the 18th and 19th centuries. And depending on what you're writing, you're going to leave certain facts out. Ultimately, the purpose of history, as I see it, is to tell a story. You are putting your narrative into the history, whether you want to or not. And the judgment calls you make about what to include and what to exclude are then, those facts are then linked by a narrative. Without a narrative, history is just a giant almanac listing dates and events. But on the other hand, you can't just have narrative. Good histories also cite the facts so you can judge the historian, because a narrative isn't falsifiable by itself. Facts are. This is how you should judge history, by how well it gets the facts correct and how well the facts fit into the narrative. The analogy that I'm going to set up is like a courtroom. We have evidence that people are going to put on, and then people are going to try to use that evidence to determine what the facts actually were. And then they're going to try to fit those facts into a narrative. And the evidence and facts can disrupt or support a narrative. If I'm a prosecutor and I'm trying to tell you that the defendant murdered another person, and I say, and he hated him. He hated him his whole life. And that's why he donated his kidney to him when his enemy was about to die. He would say, hold up, that fact doesn't fit into that narrative. If he donated his kidney to him, maybe he didn't hate him. And then the narrative is all shot. On the other hand, if I introduce a letter where the defendant talked about how much he hated the victim, then that does support my narrative. So within history, we have, instead of attorneys, we have all these different historians taking the existing facts and evidence, sometimes which there is a dispute as to. And so these historians making their arguments to the jury of public opinion. But unlike a courtroom, in history, the verdict is never final.
So I'm teaching a project right now, and we've had a lot of historical figures where their birth is disputed or their death is disputed. And depending on the source you go to, you find different information. Not that there's dispute with the facts, but the fact that as things are retold over time, they often become like facts. So there's a lot of history out there that, because it's been retold, passed down, told again, told in a certain way, we think of it as factual information when it may differ significantly from what really took place.
And that gets to something that I was trying to use the courtroom analogy to get at, which is that there's a difference between facts and evidence. So facts are what happened. Those don't change. Did he shoot him? Did he not shoot him? Was the light green when the car went through, or was it red? Evidence is what we have now. So maybe it's eyewitness testimony. Maybe it's someone said something to someone else who told it to someone else who told it to someone else, as we get a lot of history. And so when someone's in court saying the light was red, that's equivalent to what we have in history. You know, we have this oral story now, we have this written thing now, but that's different from the fact of what had actually happened at a certain point in time. We can't really disagree on the evidence. This person is saying this, this person is not saying this, but we can disagree on what the facts are, because we may disagree with, say, the reliability of a witness, things like that. And so it's this really this trifold distinction between evidence, what we have now, facts, what happened, and narrative, the explanation for how the facts fit together. That's what we're looking at when we're talking about history. We're mainly talking about the narrative, but the narrative is dependent on the facts, which is dependent on the evidence. So in American historiography, there's two main schools of thought. They are conflict history and consensus history. So conflict theory, as a distinct school, is the older. It arises out of the classic Marxist view of history as a conflict between classes. Developments among other groups, primarily illustrated by the New Left in the 60s, really adds race and sex conflict to history in addition to the traditional Marxist class conflict. In reaction to this conflict view of history, there developed a school of thought known as consensus history, which emphasized the basic unity of American values and characters. And as a reaction to primarily Marxist conflict when it was created in the 50s, it tends to be associated more with the political right, while conflict tends to be associated with the political left. But these are not exclusive characterizations. You can have conflict historians on the right, and you can have consensus historians on the left. I'll ask you, which would you say you fit in with? When you look at American history, do you think of it through the lens of conflict or through consensus?
I think more often than not, I tend to favor the conflict perspective. And I wonder if part of that is because, especially in early American history, most of the big dots on the timeline, the pieces that you really study, are conflict-based. So the founding of our nation is based in conflict. The next major stop would be conflict between the founding fathers over the Constitution versus the Articles of Confederation. Everything is presented, I think, most often through that lens. So that is the lens I feel like I identify with most.
If you view most of American history as a conflict, who would you identify as the parties that are in conflict?
I think it varies.
Would you say you're also on the conflict side, Morgan?
Yes. I think for a lot of the same reasons Lauren pointed out, conflicts are the big milestones of history when you're looking at, especially if you're looking at an overview. The founding of the United States of America is a conflict between the colonies and England. I mean, kind of either side of the big wars.
I think the class conflict way of looking at it makes a lot of sense. But when you look at more global conflicts, I think the way things are presented, conflict also has a way of uniting classes together. So I think it really just depends on what you're looking at and who's being vilified or glorified in each event.
I also hold a conflict view. I would agree with Murray Rothbard. He sees history as centrally a race and conflict between social power, the productive consequence of voluntary interactions among men, and state power. He sees conflict not as between classes, social or economic, or between ideologies, but between power and liberty, state and society. So he primarily looks at American history as a question of who will control the state and what power will the state exercise over the citizen.
The 1619 Project is a special issue of the New York Times Magazine that seeks to refocus the lens through which we look at American history. The Second Continental Congress issued the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. This is widely accepted as the advent of America. But what if we started American history on a different date? What if we examined the origins of our country as entwined with the year that the first ship carrying enslaved people arrived in the British colonies? The 1619 Project is a collection of works that centralizes slavery and Black Americans in the American narrative. Developed by Nicole Hannah-Jones and other writers, it was released in August of 2019, marking the 400th anniversary of when the first enslaved people arrived in the British colonies. Today, the project also includes a podcast, and curriculum has been developed for use in classrooms. In 2020, former President Donald Trump created the 1776 Commission. This was an advisory group, which was, as stated by Trump, established to better enable a rising generation to understand the history and principles of the founding of the United States in 1776, and to strive to form a more perfect union. This commission, headed by Carol Swain, released the 1776 report on January 18, 2021. The commission aimed to challenge narratives that they felt were put forward to reframe America's history as evil. Therefore, many view the 1776 report as a reactionary document to pieces included in the 1619 Project. The report itself came under fire for its lack of citations and footnotes, and the commission was recently dissolved on January 20th by the new administration. The report has since been deleted. Neither of the two documents are without their critics, and both should be examined together to get a clear picture of two histories with opposing goals.
So if you had to categorize these two documents into the conflict or consensus theories of history, how would you categorize them?
I think the 1619 Project, almost by definition, falls into the conflict perspective because it's putting forth a new version of history that has been told, and it's centralizing new people to the narrative. And then I think the 1776 report is designed to be more of a consensus view.
Where do you think the writers of the 1619 Project and the 1776 Commission report want their works to be influential?
They want them to be influential in schools. The 1619 Project has released curriculum. In the quote that I found directly from Trump's October 6th proclamation, he states that it's for a rising generation. So both of these are designed for the classroom.
Yeah, they both want the material in schools.
Both of these seem to be very much wrapped around the idea of having children learn the various narratives put forth in each of them. at this point, with the polarization of America, I think both sides are really attempting to get their narratives into the school curriculum, because what you're taught as a kid is what tends to stick with you. And so both sides view the classroom as an important place to gain a foothold in the next generation of America.
Gotta recruit new members.
I think public school social studies curriculum is very creepy to me. And the analysis that I've heard from several people is, think about what your reaction would be if Walmart ran the schools. And every morning the kids got in there and they pledged allegiance to Walmart. And on all the walls, there were pictures of former Walmart CEOs with ridiculous myths about them. Oh, this CEO, he never told a lie. And this CEO could throw a silver dollar across the Potomac. You'd be like, what is this nonsense? This is like Kim Jong-un stuff. But on the other hand, what's the alternative? Can you just not give them a narrative? Can you wait until they're older and not educate them when they're little? And then as soon as they turn 18, they start learning about American history. Do you try to teach American history without a narrative and just have it be an almanac of dates and events?
When you said, like, this president never told a lie or different examples, I think my favorite watered down version we provide kids with is the idea that Abraham Lincoln single-handedly ended slavery. And I dare you to go ask any kid you see on the street who ended slavery, and they will tell you Lincoln.
Even adults, if you forced somebody to give you one name, a lot of adults, the Emancipation Proclamation.
If you talk to kids and they, through no fault of their own, they'll tell you Lincoln freed the slaves. So at some point, I think some of our curriculum, we sacrifice facts for narrative, but at the same time, narrative is necessary for buy-in. So I'm not sure I'm in favor of teaching social studies with no narrative, because I really just don't know how you would ever form a schema for anything. But like Morgan said, to have grown adults still believing some of the tall tales we weave into our textbooks, it doesn't paint a true picture.
Yeah, the answer is actually pretty easy. And it's just complete and total school choice. And then we have conservative schools and left schools. And then each kid gets what their parents want. And then we're all happy.
But once again, it's whatever the parents want. You're not going to have a neutral, unbiased education.
Yeah, and I think that's impossible. I think the best solution is just to have the kids learn from the parents, and then when the kids get older, some kids will re-examine their beliefs and some won't, and that's just how life works. The 1619 Project and the 1776 Commission, they both have dates in their title, and both dates are put forward as this is when the founding of America happened. Before we get into the actual documents in later episodes, which of these do you think is closer to the truth?
I mean, if you're looking at, I guess, legally might not be the right word, but officially when we were technically separated from England, it would be 1776.
It depends on how you define beginning. Britain was not the first country to have colonies in the Americas. So in terms of even the beginning of colonization, Great Britain would not have the first date. But if you go off of the first successful established British colony, 1607, is when Jamestown, Virginia was settled, which would put the 1619 Project closer to the earliest British colonists in America. But if you really want to go off of when the colonies separated and became an independent nation, I suppose 1776 is the date that that formally occurred.
Whenever I hear the founding of America, I roll my eyes, because I think it's just a nonsensical term. If you think of America as Europe, and you think of the states as the countries of Europe, and then you think about the United States or the Union as comparable to the European Union, then you can sort of see where I'm coming from. It's just as much nonsense to talk about the founding of America as it is to talk about the founding of Europe. You can talk about the founding of each colony, just like you can talk about the founding of each country of Europe, or you can talk about the creation of the European Union, and you can talk about the creation of the United States, the union of various colonies. But those are two separate concepts. I mean, Warren Harding is credited with the creation of the term founding fathers. And using Google's Ngram search, you can see that the usage of the term founding fathers really takes off around 1920. And really one of the first people to really famously identify 1776 as the birthday of America is Abraham Lincoln in his Gettysburg Address. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. And I have a lot of problems with it. It's a nonsense term. So there were lots of North American colonies, the 13 that ultimately declared independence and banded together, plus 7 in Canada, Quebec, Nova Scotia, St. John, Newfoundland, Rupert's Land, Northwestern Territory, and the British Arctic Territories. There were also British colonies in America that Florida, both East Florida and West Florida were British colonies at the time of the Declaration of Independence. And when we talk about, well, in 1776, that's when America was founded. But even then, a union existed before 1776, because 1776 was when the states united declared independence. So if they unitedly declared independence in 1776, they had to have been united before then. And the history of the various unions of colonies in North America goes back a long time. So the first union of colonies was the New England Confederation back in the 1600s, which consists of Massachusetts, New Haven, Plymouth, and Massachusetts Bay Colony in Connecticut. And that was a military confederation to do various things like fight Indians, fight the Dutch, get mad at Rhode Island for being too free. There were various plans for unions of most of the North American continent. There was the Albany Plan that Benjamin Franklin put out. But really, when we're talking about the states that the colonies that eventually became the United States, the first meeting was actually the First Continental Congress, which excluded Georgia and also wrote a letter to Quebec, St. John's, Nova Scotia, East and West Florida. So the Second Continental Congress, which declared independence, invited Quebec, St. John, and Nova Scotia. The question is, why was it these 13 colonies out of all the North American colonies that ultimately banded together? And it's not that they were legally distinct from the other colonies, just culturally so. They were all primarily Protestant. They had a high linkage of trade, all very similar race. They were mainly English, whereas Florida had a lot of Spanish and Quebec had a lot of French. And the settlements were pretty tight and highly populated with fewer military, unlike most of Canada. And then the Second Continental Congress formalized their relationship in the Articles of Confederation and then wrote the Constitution in 1787 and began operations in 1789. Just to talk about one birthday for the founding of America is just something that I have a problem with, because I see the colonies as having distinct beginnings and histories and then banding together. So to me, I think of it much like the European Union. That's sort of the concept that I think of when I think of America.
I mean, it's a similar thing, and I think people like to simplify things. And yeah, when you're teaching children in school, much like how Laura mentioned earlier with like who ended slavery, it gets boiled down to people want to be able to put one nice, neat date and answer on things.
The other thing with it, those aren't the only colonies that were relevant to even the nations founding the colonies at that time. A lot of times when this comes up, so the colonies are grouped for educational purposes into New England, Middle, and Southern. Each region is characterized by economic and kind of vague social differences. But then there's other elements that come up that are often not part of the story. Kind of the idea that for the Boston Tea Party, which I think is one of the top narratives kids are taught about the revolution, all of the tea comes from the East India Tea Company, and they don't understand why that's relevant. And we have to go back and this, you know, more discussion about who colonized who was a major player at this time in history. And then from there, there's always questions about, wait, how did we get from these 13 over here to the rest of the US? What happened? And there's huge time gaps in when land was purchased from other places, when things became territories versus state. I guess being concise, I think the narrative of the 13 colonies makes a lot of sense. But if you talk about the founding of a nation, like you were saying, our nation has been founded in stages. And each of them, I mean, some territories come from completely different places. And each particular state has its own origin story. And not all of that dates back to 1776.
Thank you for listening to this introductory episode. Please join us next time as we begin the first few articles in a 1619 project.